We live inside architectural structures, for instance, our homes, but at the same time, they live inside our minds. In dreams, for example, we can build architectural structures, modify them, or destroy them.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz. I'm a psychoanalyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Association of New York and the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia. My guest today is Dr. Cosimo Scanaia. Dr. Scanaia is a training and supervising psychoanalyst at the Italian Psychoanalytical Society and a full member of the International Psychoanalytic Association. He has been a psychiatrist who has worked as the director of mental health department of Central Genoa for many years, where he now works in private practice. Dr. Scanaia is widely published. A number of his papers in English are On Preservations and Destruction in the Unconscious, Freud and Bion, which was published in the European Journal of Psychoanalysis in 2018, Respect for the Environment, Psychoanalytic Considerations on the Ecological Crisis, which was published in the International Journal of Psychoanalysis in 2019, and On Feelings of Those Who Have Been Expelled, Notes on Psychoanalysts Forced to Leave Genoa Because of Racial Laws of 1938, published in Trauma and Memory, also in 2019. He's written two books that have been widely translated. The first is On Pedophilia, originally published in Italian and translated into Spanish, Portuguese, Polish, French, and German. And his more recent work, which is the subject of today's conversation, Psychoanalysis and Architecture, The Inside and the Outside, published by Carnac, originally in Italian and translated into English and Spanish. As you will hear in today's interview, Cosimo valiantly struggled to help us understand him in English, which is not his first language, and I appreciated the effort he made to do that. And he shares with us a particular European, perhaps Italian point of view about the role of the environment in both reflecting our intrapsychic life and also influencing our intrapsychic life. Here is my interview with Dr. Scanaia. Cosimo, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us. In one of your papers, you bring forward a quote early on that caught my ear. And it says, speaking about music is like dancing about architecture. And you attribute that quote to Frank Zappa. And what it brought to mind is your point that various aesthetic experiences both share things in common and are also different from each other, which brings us to today's topic, which is psychoanalysis and architecture. A point you make later on in that paper is that what those two aesthetic experiences have in common is that they are both an experience and also something that one can discuss. When one walks into a well-designed room, one has an experience in relation to that well-designed room. And likewise, as we know, psychoanalysis is first and foremost an experience for the analysant. And yet for both of those experiences, walking into the room and being in analysis, one can also step back and have a conversation, an observable point of view about what that experience is. It seems to me that that's also true about a number of other aesthetic forms. Looking at a painting, sharing a glass of wine, lovemaking, Or for that matter, this conversation you and I are about to have. It will be an experience for us, hopefully an experience for our listeners, and also something that we can discuss. Share with us what it is that you find in psychoanalysis and architecture that is of special interest to you.
You know, the osmosis between the inside and the outside, I mean the continuous and changeable redefinition of the relations between these areas through their changes and transformation, is a very important issue, both at interpersonal and the intrapsychic level. We live inside architectural structures, for instance, our homes, but at the same time, they live inside our minds. In dreams, for example, we can build architectural structures, modify them, or destroy them. Although it is not the only symbolic representation of the internal world, the house in dreams is a basic and simple symbol, often appearing in infinite versions and giving an idea of the internal reality and of the dreamer's personality structure. But also, it can be the measure of the analytical process. The house can be an effective synthesis of the way in which we perceive our bodies, our relationships, and ourselves with other people, but also the relationship, the analytical relationship. The house in dreams can be old or new, rich or poor, luxurious or crumbling, warmly comfortable or inhospitable, colorful or gray. A house that is going to crumble or be demolished can represent the dreamer's fear of a breakdown or a phase of emotional instability. You know, in addition, the renovation of a ruined house can represent the attempt to make mental repairs to a damaged world during analysis. Dreaming of having been locked out of a house or having lost the keys to the front door can represent the patient's resistance in dealing with the difficult and painful complexity. Dreaming of an increasing number of home furnishings in an initially empty house can be correlated with relevant progresses in analysis and with the consequent emotional affective enrichment. This can be also valid for those dreams about new or secret rooms whose existence have never been considered or whose doors have never been opened before. The house in which we choose to live and the way in which we furnish it depend only partially on chance or the choice of others. Rather, they depend mainly on our internal world, on the deepest part of our mind, of the unconscious way we prefigure our container.
In anticipation of our speaking today, I've been reading your work on houses and spaces, as you've just described. And I must say that it has sharpened my clinical ear to be more attentive than I've been accustomed to appreciate the things you're saying, that while we know that structures represent the mind, the analytic field, certainly the body, and that changing images of those structures, like you say, for example, from debilitated to luxurious, to open or closed, to locked or available, etc., we can see a trajectory of these changes over the course of a deepening treatment, which informs us of the movement of the treatment and the hidden rooms that remain to be discovered. So I've enjoyed and learned from reading your material and now hearing you say it.
I can present you some little vignettes where it's possible to see these changements, these changes in the setting. You know, generally, the space of European analysts' consulting rooms are smaller than those of Americans. This means that the distances between the analyst's armchair and the analyzant couch, and between the analyzant perspective and the room's different furnished parts, are smaller too. In this sense, the room seems to harken back to a primitive refuge. This is an important difference. This implies a change of the perceptual level, that's to say a different mutual way of listening, of visual observation, and of proprioception in relation to proximity and separation, but also to material, acoustics, lights, and all the physical elements we must consider. Every time a young patient of mine spoke of her repressed and coerced sexuality, she did it with a subtle and feeble voice, a sort of whisper. This forced me to get close to her by moving my neck and my head to cap my ears in order to better my hearing. So she forced me to get close to her and thus make a further effort to comprehend words that could not be easily said. Her fear that I could not listen to her was projected onto me. Her childhood need to be listened to came along with her narcissistic demand of having me close to her, as if she was asking whether I would really listen to her words.
Well, let me ask you a question about that, because I remember reading what you're describing, and I put myself in your position of sitting behind a patient who, as she starts describing, and tell me if I have the scene correctly, as she starts describing sexual material, she starts speaking in a whisper. And your reaction is to, the way you said it was, feel forced to lean over and to get closer, which changes, obviously, the architecture of your space between the two of you. I was interested about the choice you made at that point, because one could do as you did. One could also comment to the patient that she suddenly started speaking more quietly, making it more difficult for you to hear as she described this particular material. I could imagine myself asking her if she were aware that she were doing that, if she was aware or became aware what her reflections are on her doing that. And in contrast to feeling forced to change your posture and the architecture between the two of you, to try to make the transformation into words. And I was curious about your thinking that led you one way or the other.
The particular architecture of my consulting room was important to understand that her whisper was something difficult to say, and not her narcissistic need to be understood by me, so to force me to get close to her. It was important, because if my consulting room was bigger, with big distance between my armchair and the couch, perhaps I could interpret the narcissism of the patient and not her need to be understood by me, like a mother who can get close to her couch. So I think that it's important in this case the distance, and but also in other cases the light, the smell, the position of the things on the table, the books, the ceiling, the floor.
And we certainly see these effects when one changes offices or redecorates an office, when it brings up a host of associations from patients about the meaning of the difference. I was curious to learn about your observation about the size of American analytic offices versus European. it leaves the question of South American offices and elsewhere in the world as an open question. But for now, we'll talk about America and Europe. Whereas your sense is that there's greater distance in the size of the office, Americans versus Europeans. I hadn't known that. A difference that has struck me is more a generational difference in the States anyway. That is that older generations of analysts had, in my experience, more austere offices. They didn't have as many, one could call distractions, personal revelations in the way one decorates and the artwork one has and the knickknacks one has, as opposed to the newer generation, which I think, to generalize, is less afraid of bringing forward more of oneself. Not to go so far as to put family pictures, which I think we agree is too much of a distraction, but to bring more, perhaps as Freud did, which was obviously to fill his office with all kinds of representations of himself. Is that something that you've noticed as well in offices, that the amount of stuff that people have is changing in Europe?
You know, I think that the definition of the setting is between two polarities. One in which the analyst is the function of the blank screen. The old analyst, the hunger, the black screen, screen, and so on. And one in which he makes an excessive of intersubjectivity, an excess of subjectivity.
Tell me what you mean by that, an excess of intersubjectivity.
An excessive self-disclosure. I think that the analyst, if they got good sense of good taste in limiting themselves to a perceptible but sober personalization of the environment, avoiding a narcissistic invasion of the working field with the exhibition of the private iconography. So it's important because, you know, I'm in Italy. Italy is the land of the beauty, of the creativity. So it's important to have a consulting room to Franciscan without anything good, anything beautiful. And overall, this is the culture of the patients. Also for the patient, another consulting room like old Kleinian analysts could be something false, something not in relation with his story, his taste, his culture.
Explain that to me. I hadn't known that Kleinian analysts have more austere offices. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. But I saw a different consulting room of Kleinian analysts. They are without painting. They are without books. Only the armchair. Only the couch. A little table.
Right.
I think you know Mies van der Rohe said less is more. And I think that this quotation is good to represent what these consulting rooms represent.
I'm fascinated by this. This is brand new information for me. And I wonder if we'll get mail or comments on the webpage from various Kleinian analysts, either agreeing or disagreeing with what you put forward. But I'm intrigued that if I understand, I want to make sure I get it right, that as a rule, with obvious exceptions, of course, Kleinian analysts tend not to bring forward much of their personalities or their aesthetic interests into their office spaces.
A lot of Kleinian psychoanalysts wrote on aesthetics, on beauty, Anna Siegel, for example. But the problem is that they think that if you have something which can represent the analyst's personality, the patient can project in this objects, in this box, in these things, and in this way avoids to stay in the relationship, in psychoanalytical relationship.
I hadn't anticipated that we would go in this direction, but what you're saying is really important. It comes down to this key notion about the role of self-revelation, as you call it, I like the term, sober self-revelation, and whether that interferes with the emergence of transference or whether, in fact, it can facilitate it. I think one best avoids a hard and fast rule about that, of course. Different patients respond differently, and different times in the trajectory of an analysis, people respond differently. But it's certainly been my experience that there are times where speaking of oneself in a comfortable, natural manner doesn't obscure transference. You can't thwart transference. You just give it a medium around which the transference will coalesce. If one listens for it, if one is exhibiting oneself, to call it that, in service of deepening the relationship with the patient and not in service of just showing off oneself because you have a need for that, that's a key distinction. If one does it in service of deepening the experience between the two people, then you are offering it as a nidus around which the patient's fantasies can coalesce, which can then be analyzed. And you're saying that that also is reflected in how austere, or your word is passion, one allows one's office to represent. That's, you mentioned being Italian. That's a word I don't think an American would use in describing their offices, that they bring their passions forward. But it certainly works when I hear you say it. Can you share with us additional clinical examples where your attention to the architectural space has played a part in the deepening of the work with the patient?
I can tell you on this experience about the light. There is a difference between the size of the windows in Italy and in the United States. For this information, I studied a lot of photographs of a consulting room of American colleagues. So I could see that difference. Generally, you know, there are perhaps a lot of different situations, but generally in Italy. But the problem is because the heat originally would be necessary for us. So the windows bigger have to reduce the possibility to have more heat inside.
So it relates to the heating systems that are common in Europe versus the States, the central heating versus the lack of central heating. I hadn't thought of that either. I'm sorry, go ahead, you were saying.
I want to speak to you on a clinical case in which the light was important. A patient of mine, on beautiful and sunny days, before starting the session, would put a pair of sunglasses to protect herself from what she felt is an excess of brightness in the room. You know, I was astonished because there was no so bright, so much, many brightness. But she put these sunglasses. This brightness could blind, I thought, could blind her and prevent her from looking at herself. She was, in that moment, so feeble, in difficulty, that it was impossible to have a connection, a relationship with her. The brightness did not leave space for this need for privacy and intimacy, like, I thought, a semi-darkness. Wearing her sunglasses was a clear indication of her degree of tolerance of my interpretations. When she wore them, it was as if she said to me that she would have experienced my interpretations as if I were turning on a very intense light in a dark place.
Can you share with us how you dealt with that? In other words, I could see somebody choosing to leave it, to not even comment on the sunglasses until such time as the patient brought it up or the patient just naturally stopped using the sunglasses. I could also see somebody commenting on the sunglasses, just bringing it to her attention to let her associate to it. What did you do in the face of it?
Yeah, but it was very interesting because when she wore her sunglasses, she told me to stay calm, not to interpret. But on the contrary, when she did not wear her sunglasses, it was if she took my interpretations as flashes in the dark, more or less as fireflies in the countryside at night. So it's important to how she feels the brightness and what it's important for her, but also for me. And I think that if my window was bigger, probably my possibility of perceiving certain indication was less, was not so significant. Perhaps the patient would have more difficulties in representing her degree of tolerance of my interpretations without her sunglasses. But, you know, I remember a little story, the experience of temporariness and promiscuity of a patient who, before asking to start analysis with me, had been in treatment with an analyst who made him lie down on a common living room sofa. The patient fantasized that his analyst used to drink coffee with his guests on this sofa, and then that he put his head where people put their asses. In this sense, he fantasized that no place, no sofa included, could be a non-promiscuous place and unique for him.
Cosimo, can you share with us, you have an interest and a sensitivity, not to mention a pleasure, in discerning environments and listening for their meanings in you and in the patient. Can you share with us a bit of your background? What brings you to this? We all have our histories, and it's reflected in what we pursue and what fascinates us. Can you tell us a bit about who you are that brings you to architecture and psychoanalysis?
I was born in a city in the south of Italy. I moved when I was young, so I am an immigrant. And it was very important for me to connect different cultures. So the idea to connect different cultures, to put together what the culture of the south of Italy, of the north of Italy, was important for me to study the possibility to organize connections with the different cultures. And when I was a psychiatrist and directed the mental health service in Genoa, also was important as psychiatrist and as psychoanalyst to connect inside and outside internal space and outside space. And you know, I was born in a city with a lot of art, with a lot of beauty, with a lot of creativity, and I think that creativity for me is the possibility to have the power to disregard the imposed dichotomy of real and possible versus dream, imagined, and impossible. It's important in relationship with patients. It's important for the patient. It's important for the psychoanalyst, for his or her reverie. And if you want, I remember a little story from René Magritte. René Magritte painted a picture. Its name was A Big Tree at Night Time with a Crescent Moon above it. And this is in a series that says September, 16th of September. And in an exhibition of his paintings, a young girl spoke to René Magritte as follows of the crescent moon before the tree. She said, "I love it when the moon is hidden behind the leaves." To which Magritte replied, "I love it when the moon is hidden behind the leaves too, but if we saw them behind the moon as well, that would be unbelievable. Life would finally have some meaning." So it's important how he, Magritte, by superimposing the moon onto the foliage, became a master of creativity. And I think that we, as psychoanalysts and the patients, could be masters of creativity in this way, in relationship between our dreams, our reveries, in the field of the relationship, to put together inside and outside.
You so beautifully describe your background of appreciating as a child the artistic space and how it so naturally grew in you into appreciating the analytic space and how you go back and forth between the two. And in fact, like you say, the name of your book, which has been translated in English as well as Spanish and, of course, in the original Italian, is Psychoanalysis and Architecture, the Inside and the Outside. So my question that I began our chat today with about what the inside and the outside means to you and how architecture and psychoanalysis reflects that inside and outside, you've answered not only in the words that you've said, but also in the spirit and the delight that you've shared in immersing yourself in this space. I want to thank you for spending time with us. Thank you for making an effort to speak in English. I know it can be challenging, and I appreciate your effort. The listeners who are interested can certainly also read your books and your writings. And it's been a pleasure, a real learning experience, I might add, for me to turn my attention to the subject that you've written and spoken about so well. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your good interview, and I hope to see as soon as possible.
That would be great. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also